Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. As human beings, we all have ambitions and goals. For a number of people all across the world, their life's ambition is quite simply to have a large family. In a perfect world, babies are born into hard-working families that do their best to provide for them a loving home and a stable environment. But what about those that are seen as nothing more than a source of income or a commodity? Mick Philpott first saw his name in the headlines in 2006 when he requested a bigger council house for his massive family. Philpott had fathered 17 children by a number of different women, and to fund his large family, he relied solely on state benefits. His lifestyle was something which angered a number of hard-working Britons who felt as though he was procreating solely as a means of income. Britain had almost forgotten about the Philpott family when in 2012, a tragedy struck when their house went up in flames, opening one of the most lurid and sensational criminal investigations that the United Kingdom had ever seen. Mick Philpott had a history of being violent, domineering, and controlling towards women, and he preyed on young and damaged women who came from troubled backgrounds. When Philpott was just 21 years old in 1978, he went AWOL from the army. It was during this time that he attempted to kill his 17-year-old girlfriend, Kim Hall, who he had been dating for 2 years. Throughout the couple's relationship, Philpott was extremely controlling and abusive.
I used to have to be in for about 8 or 8, and I was a bit late. And I was walking down the hill to get to our house, and about 2 doors down, he jumped out and he wanted to know where I'd been and all that, and I told him where I'd been and that, and he called me a liar and I was cheating on him, and that was the first time he ever hit me. And it was sort of slaps around the face and that. Oh, he started crying after that, saying he was sorry, it'd never happen again, don't finish with him and all this, that and the other, don't tell me dad and that, and I didn't. I felt sorry for him. I thought, no, you know, it's not him. But then it started happening a little bit more frequent. He used to play in the pool team at the local pub, and me and my cousin was sat watching, and they wanted to play doubles. So, and he hadn't got a partner, so he wanted me to play, and I said, no, I'm talking to my cousin. He got the thick end of the pool cue and whacked it straight across my mouth in front of a pub load of blokes, and not one of them did anything.
On one occasion, Philpott shot Hall in the groin with a crossbow because he felt that the dress she was wearing was too short, and had also smashed her kneecap with a hammer when she was paying too much attention to a baby that she had been looking after. Hall was desperate to end the relationship and finally saw her chance when Philpott was enlisted in the army. She sent him a letter and told him that she was leaving him. Carried away by jealousy and anger, Philpott abandoned the army and broke into Hall's home while she was fast asleep.
He waited for my dad to go to work, which was around about the midnight time. Gone into the house and actually sat in the front room for 2 hours. He'd gone through my purse to call me money. He'd gone through drawers, he'd gone through all sorts. And it was my dad's knife, dad's flick knife, that he got out of the drawer that he used on us. I sensed that somebody was in my room. Something wasn't right. And I opened my eyes. The next thing, this hand comes over my mouth. And he went, fucking scream and I'll kill you. So he takes his hand away. What's the first thing I'm going to do? Scream. And he says, I told you, if I can't have you, no fucker's having you. And I remember I was screaming. And the next thing, my mum's at my bedroom door. And then she'd gone, and he'd gone. And I looked down, and there was all this blood seeping through my fingers. And then the next thing, I heard all this noise and commotion, and I tried to get up and I couldn't.
He proceeded up the stairs and into Hall's bedroom, where he stabbed her 27 times while she was asleep. When Hall's mother heard the commotion, she rushed to her daughter's bedroom. Philpott stabbed her mother 11 times as well. A neighbour who heard the screams called 999. When paramedics arrived, Philpott was sitting on the front porch, still holding the bloody knife. He began laughing and told the paramedics not to bother going inside because he had, quote, done a job on her, end quote.
He stabbed me 27 times and then tried to, obviously the long one, tried to gut me. Apparently I was just completely ripped open. He'd gone through both lungs, my liver, my kidneys, my bladder, my bowel.
Miraculously, Hall survived after sustaining collapsed lungs and a punctured bladder, kidney and liver. Her mother also survived the attack. Philpott was found guilty of attempted murder and grievous bodily harm. He was sentenced to serve 7 years but was released from prison after just 3 years and 2 months.
I've had a lot of operations to remove things and remove scar tissue and cysts and... which is what he caused. I had to have a hysterectomy quite early in age because I got a prolapse wound through the scarring and everything. It ruined my life.
Following his release, Philpott used his conviction as a scare tactic to threaten women into doing what he asked. He married a woman named Pamela Lomax in 1986, and the couple went on to have 3 children, David, Richard and Michaela. They separated around 10 years later, and Philpott took to grooming underage girls, including 14-year-old Heather Kehoe. Kehoe fled her family home to live with Philpott, who was 37 years old at the time. Next, we will hear from criminologist Jane Monckton-Smith.
I think his preference for younger, more vulnerable girls gives us quite a few clues about his personality and how he relates to the world and how he relates to women. He likes to have younger women that he can manipulate and control.
Kehoe gave birth to 2 boys in quick succession. They named them Mickey and Aiden. While the birth of a baby should be cause for celebration, Philpott responded by beating up Kehoe because he wanted a daughter. As Mickey and Aiden grew up, Philpott taught them to be violent towards their mother, often encouraging them to punch her in the face and kick her. Their neighbour, Chantel Harriet, recalls often seeing Kehoe with bruising.
Ever used to have black eyes and bruises and stuff. You know, you'd say, have you done that? You know, it looks a bit nasty and... oh, I've walked into the door, or oh, I've done this silly hoovering, I've bent down there and bang, it's hit me, and you knew really he'd done it, do you know what I mean? And she was scared to say anything.
Then in 1991, Philpott was discharged from the British Army and received a 2-year conditional discharge for assault and bodily harm after he headbutted a colleague. In early 2000, Kehoe finally escaped from Philpott, taking their children with her. Within months, Philpott met 19-year-old Maria Duffy, a single mother who had just recently gotten out of an abusive relationship. She was vulnerable, isolated and young, an easy target for Philpott. Within days, Duffy moved into Philpott's 3-bed council house at 18 Victory Road in Derby. Then in 2003, the couple were married. Shortly thereafter, Philpott took 18-year-old Lisa Willis, the couple's bridesmaid, as a mistress. As a matter of fact, Willis was pregnant with Philpott's baby during his wedding to Duffy.
He loves us both the same. He don't treat us any different. Where I am married to, I've got his name. But he don't treat us any different.
It don't bother me that I'm not married. It don't bother me one bit. I mean, I was his bridesmaid, for God's sake. To me, it was their day at the end of the day. But I didn't enjoy the night time because I was pregnant. I was due to drop.
So Willis and her son from a previous relationship shacked up in the council home with Philpott, his wife and their numerous children. In a short matter of time, Philpott had fathered 4 children by Duffy and 3 by Willis. In March of 2006, Philpott was featured in numerous British tabloids after practically demanding a bigger council house for him and his family. At the time, there were 11 people living in the three-bedroom house which had been provided by the council. A council spokeswoman said that the family already owned the biggest available council house in Derby. Philpott was furious when he was told that there were no bigger houses available and that their home had space to accommodate up to 16 people. Philpott took to the media and said that when his two sons from his relationship with Kehoe came to visit, he and Duffy were forced to sleep in a tent in the back garden. According to Philpott, the council were just making up excuses when they said that there wasn't a larger home available. Quote, "They're just not good enough. I love my country, but at the moment I feel ashamed of it. I think the country is going down the pan," end quote, he told the Birmingham Post. According to some sources, the family were receiving benefits of £40,000 a year. According to some other sources, however, that figure was closer to around £60,000.
I think I should be allowed a bigger property. Because I'm unemployed, I should be getting a little bit of help from the council.
Oh yeah, Derbyshire Council, blah, 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 will help Mr. Philpott as much as possible, right? What have I got to do to get somebody to actually listen? It's not my fault, because at the end of the day, it's down to the council to be able to sort us out.
When the articles hit the shelves, Philpott received a lot of criticism for his lifestyle. He just shrugged it off and told the Daily Mirror, quote, "All that matters is my family," end quote. He told numerous newspapers that people were just jealous of his living situation, stating that every man in Britain would love to live with two women if they could. Philpott's ex, Kehoe, also took to the media, stating that she could solve Philpott's overcrowding problem by banning him from seeing their sons, Mickey and Aidan. Kehoe said that the living situations in the Philpott household were immoral and that she didn't want to expose her children to that kind of environment. She also claimed that Philpott kept having children purely to get more benefits. Philpott was said to relish in the publicity he was receiving. He opened his doors to numerous camera crews and reporters and chatted openly about what he perceived as the issues in Britain. But less than a week later, journalists dug up his 1978 attempted murder charge, making for another lurid headline. When questioned about this crime, Philpott said that both Duffy and Willis knew about his past and accepted him nevertheless. He said that the attempted murder charge was the reason that he couldn't get a job. With all of the media coverage on Philpott, he received a visit from bailiffs. As it turned out, Philpott hadn't paid his full council tax in 2 years. He was ordered to pay the tax or the bailiffs would return in 2 weeks to seize his property to cover the costs. Philpott sneered that he wouldn't pay the tax, stating that he'd rather be kicked out of their home and rehoused in a bigger one. Eventually, he paid up and remained in his three-bedroom house. Shortly thereafter, Willis gave birth to her fourth child by Philpott, and then the family announced that both Willis and Duffy were pregnant once again, and they were both due in March of 2007.
At this present moment, I am on cloud nine. I'm buzzing. I've just had child number 17. There's going to be a lot of people out there that's going to say, "Oh, look, the scum, the scrounger, the shameless Mick has done it again." Well, I'll tell you what. Fuck all of you, because at the end of the day, my life, my wife's life, Lisa's life, we do what we want. We don't care what you people think. At the end of the day, we're happy, so stop the lot of you.
Around the same time, Philpott invited the Daily Mirror into the family's home for an exclusive interview. Once again, he reiterated his earlier complaints about the council not providing him with a bigger home. He also told the journalist that Duffy and Willis take it in turns to sleep with him in their second-hand caravan, which was parked in the driveway outside the house.
Now, normally, if this caravan's rocking, you may not come knocking because this is where it all happens. As you can see, this is a nice big king-sized bed. This is where the action takes place, if you know what I mean. I'm not going to say too much about it, but yeah. One night I'll have Mairead in here, and then the next night I'll have Lisa in.
While the house was cramped, it certainly didn't lack the luxuries that a number of British full-time workers couldn't afford. In the living room, they had a 42-inch widescreen television, as well as a number of laptops. In the driveway sat a Mitsubishi shotgun 4x4.
He keeps trying to tell me he's religious, but he's not religious. He just reads one part of the Bible. Go forth, my children, and multiply. That's what he's doing.
Are you having any more babies?
I fucking am.
Either her or Liz will be pregnant in 6 months' time. Mick loved his kids. He built climbing frames in the back garden, trampoline, swimming pool. They had everything they wanted.
Now I'm going to say to you and the council, fuck you all, because if the situation comes to the situation, I will build in my garden. And you can come round the council, come round and say, well, you've not had planning permission. Fuck your planning permission. I've not had planning permission to have all these kids in this house. So they're breaking the law. So it's going to work both ways. One way or the other, I will get what I want.
During the interview, Philpott also said that the most recent pregnancies came as a surprise, despite the fact that he admitted to not wearing condoms, stating that they, quote, spoil sex, end quote. He also confessed that around a year earlier, he had cheated on Duffy and Willis with his friend's girlfriend, who now, unsurprisingly, was also pregnant.
I think it's a load of shit.
Jesse.
I think it's a load of fucking shit. I think it's a load of crap. Nothing said about that being overcrowded in the house, is it? You know? I'm fucking annoyed. The fact is, they missed the most important part out. You know, we're living in cramped conditions. Right, I'll kick Lisa out my ass and let her move back in property on her own, which is going to cost them fucking twice more money than what it's going to cost me. You know, you can't win. Fuck them.
Once again, Philpott sparked outrage and a number of Britons called for his benefits to be slashed. One local woman named Yvonne Wilson wrote into the newspaper The Sun, quote, Mick Philpott is still procreating, unconcerned about how he will pay his bills. Meanwhile, working people whose taxes keep him have to plan carefully to afford even one child. If someone is unfortunate enough to become unemployed, they should only be able to claim for children who already exist. I don't expect Philpott would have fathered two more children if he had to support them himself, end quote. In 2007, it was announced that ITV were producing a documentary wherein Tory MP Anne Widdecombe would stay with the Philpott family for a week, documenting his lifestyle. During filming, Widdecombe found Philpott three separate jobs, but he refused to show up. The documentary was an uncomfortable watch, to say the very least.
He was known to be shameless and very willing to talk openly about it. He was one of the worst examples of abuse that you could find. He had 11 children. They were meal tickets, effectively. He kept a wife and a mistress. He had one child by each every year, pretty well. Living in a three-bedroomed council house, he was campaigning for a larger house. He seemed to think it was an opportunity for him to make the case to get a bigger house.
This is the caravan.
This is the caravan, look, where you'll be sleeping.
Which you use as a sort of spare room, yeah?
Yeah.
As soon as I started pressing him on work on the morality of deliberately living on everybody else, he started to get very knocked indeed.
Why do you go out and work?
Right, just shut your gob and listen.
Go out and work.
I am
get
working.
Get a job.
I'm looking after my
get
kids.
Get a job.
Got very angry, and there was a point when he moved suddenly, and I really thought he was going to hit me. And I flinched back. I thought, this is it.
You're a coward.
Let's see who's a coward, bitch. Let's f*** move it.
I mean, I'd been slightly worried throughout the whole programme that he might actually get physically aggressive. But I really thought that was the moment. It didn't happen. He had control. He knew when to, you know, when to be careful. He knew the cameras were there.
At one point in the documentary, it appeared as though Widdecombe was about to be attacked by Philpott after she branded him a coward. Philpott had also appeared on the popular ITV talk show Jeremy Kyle. The show is pretty much an examination of the underclass and sometimes the mentally ill. The unsympathetic host, who earned around £2 million a year, booked guests solely to discuss their misfortunes.
You don't work.
Oh, yes, I do work.
Yeah, I know your argument on this. Just give it to us. You say I look after my kids. What's wrong with a man looking after his kids other than a woman?
That's correct. What is wrong with a man looking after his children? I mean, I'm old-fashioned. I believe the man should be at work, but unfortunately, because the media keeps putting a certain story in the paper, I cannot get a job.
You can't get a job because of what?
Criminal record.
Six.
I said, you're doing
it.
Why
are you so defensive?
Because when it comes to my kids, I'm very, very
I've just complimented your kids.
After I had a go at you.
I just said that
listen,
ever
just
since...
Get out, just talk to that, pal. Talk to that. You're not worth it.
I complimented your kids. I complimented your kids and I sat and listened to you and all I was saying was how good they looked. You have jumped out of your box with one hell of a chip on your shoulder. You haven't even had anybody say anything to you so far.
I don't
and
have
you're
to.
Making signs.
I,
no,
I don't have to.
No. You've no reason to do that. But I'll tell you something. When a grown man who purports to be a good father, probably he is, sits on national television and does that, no wonder you can't get a damn job because...
When Philpott appeared on the show, he was heavily confronted by the host about his reluctance to get a job and provide for his family himself. The Jeremy Kyle show was finally suspended in May of 2019 when a guest committed suicide shortly after a public confrontation on the show. With the media focused on Philpott's lack of a job and the benefits he was being given, most people didn't even know that he was controlling, manipulative, and violent towards his wife and mistress. He controlled their finances, and in 2010, he was given a police caution after slapping Duffy and dragging her outside by her hair. On one occasion, he attacked Willis with a piece of wood when she refused to accept his assertion that their son had been fathered by her sister's husband. The assertion continued throughout the relationship, and Philpott forbid Willis from speaking to any other man.
Domestic abuse is now universally acknowledged to be made up of a pattern of behaviours. Certainly controlling behaviours like controlling access to money, isolating women from their friends and family, controlling their interaction with the outside world. All of these behaviours together actually are more dangerous than consistent violence.
Then in February of 2012, Willis finally fled the home under the pretense that she was going swimming. She moved in with her sister and her brother-in-law, as well as the four children she had with Philpott and one from a previous relationship. When Willis didn't return to the home, Philpott obsessively rang and texted her, asking her to return. Willis stood her ground and refused. Willis was concerned that Philpott may try and take their children away from her, so she initiated court proceedings for a residency order for the children and a non-molestation order. She wasn't opposed to Philpott having contact with the children, but there was no way that Phyllis was going to surrender residency. When Philpott learnt this, he was absolutely furious. It was around 4 a.m. on the 11th of May 2012 when Joe Peel, a neighbour of the Philpott family, awoke in the middle of the night to the sound of his dog barking. He sat up in bed and glanced towards the window and immediately noticed that outside appeared to be unnaturally foggy. Upon closer inspection, however, he realised that Philpott's house was engulfed in flames. He called the fire department and bolted towards the Philpott's home. A number of other neighbours, including brothers Jamie Butler and Darren Butler, rushed to the source of the blaze. They spotted Philpott in the garden frantically smashing the windows of the conservatory attached to the back of the house and screaming for his children, who were all apparently still inside the burning building.
When I looked out the window and I seen the fire up the door, it was instant. I just went with my brother and said, "Oh, the house is on fire."
Naturally, I thought that our house was on fire. And he said, "No, Mick's house is on fire. We've got to get the kids out. You know, there's kids over there." So with that, my brother's gone.
I ran up the street and I got to the front and it was just a wall of fire. I was thinking, "Oh my God, that's gone, that's grown so fast." As soon as I jumped over the caravan, I said, "But where's the kids, Mick? They're all in the back bedroom." And when I climbed the ladder, I noticed that the window was smashed, and I tried to shout through the window, but it was like putting your mouth around an exhaust pipe of a car.
I didn't go into the house. I was on the top of the caravan. There was a side window at the top of the caravan. Smoke was coming out of there, and it was more smoke than fire, you know. The smoke was black, thick smoke.
I was running around his kitchen, his conservatory, trying to get in. Trying to get forward.
thinking his little kids upstairs.
They assisted Philpott in trying to get into one of the top bedrooms using a ladder. Beaten back by the thick black smoke and unable to get in, Philpott called 999. By the time the fire department arrived, 4 minutes later, billowing smoke was emanating from the semi-detached house. Around 30 firefighters battled to put out the flames, but the flames and the smoke had rapidly spread throughout the house, completely thwarting rescue attempts. Gavin Tomlinson was one of the first firefighters on the scene.
Because of where the fire started at the foot of the stairs, and the fact the fire spread up the stairs, in effect cut off any exit route for the children. So essentially anyone up there was trapped and there was no way they could get out.
When they tackled the blaze, they quickly located the lifeless bodies of 6 children and brought them outside into the fresh air where ambulance crews worked tirelessly to resuscitate them.
Just to the top of the stairs, there's a bedroom almost straight in front of you. That was the first room they went into, and in that room they did find one child. They went into the next room where they found 2 more children.
Jamie and Darren Butler remembers the horrific scene.
Her hair was black. And I put her straight in the ambulance. And then that was it, the boys started coming at him. And I was trying to resuscitate him, and you just know as soon as you see him come out. The little souls were gone, man.
Tragically, it was much too late. 5 of the children died at the scene, and they were identified as Philpott and Duffy's children. 10-year-old Jade, 9-year-old John, 8-year-old Jack, 7-year-old Jesse, and 5-year-old Jaden. They had all died in the blaze after getting trapped upstairs. Their 6th son, 13-year-old Dwayne, was still clinging to life and was rushed to Royal Derby Hospital, where he remained in critical condition. Family friends Sharon and Mick Russell recollect seeing Dwayne in the hospital and the children in the mortuary.
We went in to see Dwayne, and it was just heartbreaking to see him there fighting for his life. The morning we went to see the children in the morgue, we met Mick and Mairead outside. They asked if we'd go with them, and I said yes. It's probably one of the worst things I've ever had to do in my life.
It tore me apart. It tore me apart. 6 beautiful little children just taken away like that.
Mairead was crying. My husband got very upset. He was crying. And Mick was hugging my husband, said, come on, it'll be all right. It's all right.
He was comforting me. I can't understand. He was coming to me. I was crying, sitting there crying, my head up. And he was coming to me. You know, I'm supposed to be the one comforting him.
Philpott and Duffy, who said that they had been asleep downstairs in the conservatory, had escaped the inferno uninjured. According to Philpott, he had made a valiant attempt to rescue his children, but to no avail. The tragic deaths had a large effect, not only on the community, but also within the emergency services and fire department. Despite the controversy surrounding the unconventional family, the community rallied around Philpott and Duffy, offering them their condolences and support. Quote, there had been a lot of negative publicity about him over the years, but no family deserves this. It is an absolute shock. No parent should have to go through losing one child, let alone 5. From my experiences of Mick, he has always been a pleasant man. He adored his children, end quote, said neighbour Sam Smith. Victory Road was cordoned off by police and an investigation was carried out. The first point of investigation was to discover where the fire started. It was soon uncovered that petrol had been poured into the letterbox, sparking a murder investigation. The following day, it was announced that a 28-year-old woman and a 38-year-old man had been arrested under suspicion of murder. According to a police source, the woman had a connection to the family, but he wouldn't elaborate any further. While the woman wasn't identified by police, Philpott made it obvious that the woman arrested had been Lisa Willis. He claimed that Willis had been threatening him and his family in the run-up to the fire.
I went round there 2 weeks, like, before the fire had happened, and he was just, like, sort of clapping his hands, oh, when I've got her now, and I've got her here, look, threatening to burn my arse up. I'll see her in court, I'll soon have my kids home.
As a matter of fact, just 6 hours after the fire spread through the home, Philpott had been scheduled to appear in Derby County Court concerning the injunction brought against him by Willis. Almost as soon as the blaze was extinguished, Philpott began to imply that Willis had started the fire so that he wouldn't be granted custody of the children. It was soon publicly announced that the man and woman who had been arrested in relation to the fire was Willis and her brother-in-law, Ian Cousins. It was also announced that they were both being released without charge after extensive interrogation and investigation. The only reason that they had been arrested in the first place was because Philpott had told the police that he was certain that they were involved in the fire. Following their release, Assistant Chief Constable Steve Cotterill said, quote, "We are still treating the fire as suspicious and are pursuing a number of lines of inquiry," end quote. Meanwhile, neighbours launched an online fund called Catch Me When I Fall to raise money for the funerals of Jade, John, Jack, Jesse and Jaden. The garden of the fire-damaged home was decorated with toys, flowers and cards of condolences. A fundraiser was also organised to go towards the funeral costs. When a number of Philpott's friends wanted to donate towards the fund, Philpott instead urged them to hand the money directly to him, stating that it would be going towards the funeral. Then on the 13th of May, Philpott and Duffy made the decision to turn 13-year-old Dwayne's life support off. Doctors at Birmingham Children's Hospital said that the injuries he had sustained in the fire were so serious that it was highly unlikely that he would have survived. By this point, autopsies had been performed on Dwayne's younger siblings, and it was concluded that they had all died from smoke inhalation. Shortly thereafter, police announced that they had not yet had a chance to speak to Philpott or Duffy about the fire. Police officer Steve Cotterill stated, quote, "That will happen sometime this week, as understandably, the couple are distraught at the loss of their 6 children, end quote. He also urged anyone who may have any information about the arson attack to please come forward. Quote, "My plea in this case is to remember that we are trying to find out exactly what caused the death of young children who had everything to look forward to in life. If someone has confided in you, now is the time to speak up and do the right thing." End quote. After Willis was released, she was hounded by the media and portrayed as a jealous ex-girlfriend out to get revenge. She moved away from her home to a local hotel where police provided her with security. Meanwhile, Philpott and Duffy made their first public appearance since the fire.
First of all, I want to thank my 3 oldest children because they helped us to cope with what's going off. And then there's a young lad called Daniel Stevenson who tried to get in the house the same as myself, Joe across the road, and the Butler brothers. And of course, there's the 4 firemen. The police, the ambulances, the doctors, the nurses, literally everybody who tried to help save our children, they couldn't. Excuse me a minute. Have you had enough? We've decided that through our son Dwayne, and unfortunately the last one to pass away, that we're going to donate his organs to save another child, which is what we want, because if you can save another child, that makes us happy. It takes a bit of the pain away, and we can't express our gratitude to everybody that's been concerned with the case, with what's been going on. I've actually been down to our home, and what we saw, we just cannot believe it. We grew up in a community that's been had a lot of problems with violence and God knows what else, and to see this community to come together like they have, it's just too overwhelming. We've had people from America, France, even the travelling community, it's just, we've been to see them, it's just overwhelming, isn't it? But I say, I can't express enough the police, the fire brigade and the ambulance services, because what we feel, them poor gentlemen from the fire brigade saw what we've seen, you know, my heart goes out to them, because it's not just us that's suffering, it's them as well, it's everybody. But there's one thing I would request is please leave my family alone. If you've got any questions or anything at all, please don't come through me or my family. Please go to the police, because what's happening at the moment, you're disrupting what these officers are trying to do. So please, I beg you, leave us alone and let us try and live in peace and quiet. That's all I ask. Thank you.
During the press conference, it was noticed that Philpott didn't address his children or beg for anybody with any information to come forward. With Willis and her brother-in-law now ruled out as suspects, investigators were trying to figure out another motive for the senseless attack. They questioned whether the attack was the result of a personal grudge against Philpott and his family, or whether they had potentially been targeted due to his celebrity status in the media. It was common knowledge that Philpott and his large family lived in the home on Victory Road, and whoever set the blaze knew all too well that all of the children would have been asleep upstairs. On the 18th of May, an inquest was opened into the children's deaths. The inquest heard that John, Jack, Jesse, Jaden and Jade were all declared dead by the time they reached the Royal Derby Hospital. It was here that they were identified by their father. Dr. Robert Hunter, the pathologist who conducted the autopsies, made an appeal during the inquest for the killer to come forward on the grounds of human decency. As the inquest was underway, Philpott once again spoke to the media, but this time he shared his worries that he and Duffy were going to be targeted by the same person who committed the arson attack. He said that somebody clearly had a grudge against his family, and that he was under police protection. Many couldn't help but notice that Philpott appeared to be reveling in the publicity, even flirting with several female journalists and doctors at the hospital. Family friend Mick Russell recollects a conversation that he had with Philpott shortly after the blaze.
He was doing things that a normal human being wouldn't do. Me and Sharon was like walking down the hallway and he was behind us. And all of a sudden he shouts, "Mick," and I turn around and he's grabbing this woman's bum and saying, "This is what I like," and I just turn around and I think, "Is this lots of kids, mate? How can you go on like that?"
According to police officer Steve Cotterill, when he met Philpott before his first press conference, he said that in his 30 years of policing, he had never seen anyone act the way Philpott acted after a similar devastating loss.
I met with both of them in a private room, obviously, to brief them, and he seemed to come in very, very jovial, really, a very jovial manner, as though it was some kind of game, it appeared. There was no heartfelt appeal for that information to come in, find who's killed my children. It just didn't come. So I took an early decision then to take them out of the room. I was somewhat behind, and as I came through some double doors into the corridor leading to the room we were using, I found him collapsed on the floor, surprisingly. I can only describe it really as being childlike. And akin to a child feigning collapse or feigning illness and playing around on the floor. And within a matter of probably 10, 20 seconds, he was back up on his feet and into the room, laughing and joking as he was before.
Philpott also didn't appear to be a grieving father. In fact, he had joked to his friends Mick and Sharon Russell that when he saw his children's burned bodies, he said that they looked like, quote, gollywogs, end quote. At one point in the investigation, Philpott suggested selling mementos left as a shrine on Victory Road, and even asked police if he could have any of the leftover cash from the donations that went towards the funeral. Even in death, Philpott saw his children as little more than sources of income.
The behaviour, it was just strange, the way they was acting. And I started to have my suspicion, going downtown shopping for clothes, and I just think, you know, I couldn't function if that was me. I wouldn't want to get up in the morning.
Investigators couldn't help but notice that things just weren't adding up with Philpott's story. Furthermore, a more thorough investigation of the crime scene indicated that the petrol hadn't been poured through the letterbox, but instead had been poured across the entrance hall from the inside of the home. Inside, investigators also discovered petrol on Philpott and Duffy's clothing, as well as in the sink. Philpott claimed that the petrol had come from a strimmer, however the petrol inside the strimmer was of a different brand. Due to the findings, investigators were granted permission to monitor Philpott and Duffy with covert recordings. During these recordings, they discovered that the couple had been having threesomes with a man named Paul Mossley. Furthermore, recordings captured all three speaking about their alibis on the night of the arson attack and captured Philpott asking Duffy if she would stick to her story.
What did you say? Tell me what you said to me. What did you say about how many times I went up ladders?
I lost count how many times I went up the ladders.
What did you say about me trying to get in?
You tried everything you could to get in, like I said to him, I wanted to run through the flames.
He was heard saying things like, are we sticking to the story? What did you tell the police? What did you tell? How badly did you cry? Did you really cry your eyes out?
What did you cry when you were saying it? How bad?
Not really, really bad, but I did cry.
That's circle.
Then on the 28th of May, Philpott, Duffy, and Mossley were arrested in Derby city centre on suspicion of murder. They all denied any involvement, but the recorded evidence was damning. During the investigation, two women came forward to say that they had been raped by Philpott. The first woman said Philpott had raped her as they slept downstairs on the floor of a relative's home in Derby in 1996. The second woman said she visited Philpott in 2005 and that he drugged her cup of tea and raped her in his caravan. Even after his arrest, Philpott showed little concern for his children.
After being charged with killing his six kids and arson and everything, he's still saying, when I get out of jail, we're going to spend the day, all day at the grave with the kids, whether it's raining, snowing, and we will rape each other. In fact, yes, we will rape each other. You know, it's just all revolves around sex all the time for him.
The trial for Mick Philpott, Maria Duffy and Paul Mossley opened in February of 2013 at Nottingham Crown Court. Prosecutor Richard Latham QC argued that the fire had been set by the trio in a bid to try and frame Willis, while Philpott had intended on playing the hero who saved his children from the blaze. They had anticipated that this would lead to Philpott being granted full custody of his and Duffy's children. Fire had been started when they poured petrol throughout the hallway of the house, but the planned rescue went terribly wrong when the blaze spread in seconds. The flames would have surged up the UPVZ front door, melting the plastic and quickly progressing up the staircase, aided by varnished wood panelling. All of the upstairs doors had been left open, allowing smoke to quickly flood the bedrooms where the children were fast asleep. An open window at the top of the stairs created a chimney effect, which helped draw the flames and smoke up the stairs. The children didn't stand a chance. Latham QC also argued that there was a secondary motivation in the arson attack, and that was that the couple could get a bigger council house. Philpott had allegedly theorised that when he won custody of the children and obtained a bigger house, Willis would have no option but to return to him. The prosecution stated that Willis leaving the family home was the catalyst for everything that followed, and that Philpott was deeply troubled by her leaving, to the point that he even attempted suicide. Quote, what she had done challenged the very core of his attitude to his family and his women. She stood up to him and he was no longer in control, and that was absolutely unacceptable to him, end quote, said Latham. In court, it emerged that Philpott was on bail for a violent road rage incident at the time of the murders. In November of 2011, Philpott had followed a man who he believed pulled out in front of him on a roundabout. The man was with his 13-year-old daughter when Philpott forced them off the road and punched the driver in the face. Philpott was subsequently arrested for the assault after a number of witnesses took down his license plate number and called police. Throughout the 8-week trial, Philpott, Duffy and Mosley denied any involvement in the blaze. When Philpott was asked by his barrister, Anthony Orchard, QC, if he had any suspicions as to who could have set the fire, he replied, quote, I do, end quote. Philpott then gave the jury his version of events. He claimed he was awoken in the middle of the night by the smoke alarm, and he saw bright lights and thick smoke. According to Philpott, his first thought were his kids. Philpott told the jury that he had hit both Duffy and Willis in the past, and that he and Duffy had gone dogging, both before and after the fire. In addition, he confessed that in the hours before the fire, he, Duffy and Mosley had a threesome on the pool table in the house. The sordid lives of the Philpott family dominated the front pages of the media, and the coverage prompted many moral dilemmas. In a way, the tragic deaths of the six children were completely overshadowed by the lifestyle of their parents. To many journalists, covering the Philpott trial was the toughest story of their career, and there was a thin line between sensationalism and good taste.
It shouldn't have been about that. It should have been about those children. They were complete innocents, and they've paid a price for their dad being Mick Philpott.
And the saddest thing is that I doubt anybody will remember the names of those six children. Dwayne, Jade, John, Jack, Jesse, and Jaden. But I guarantee every one of us will remember Mick Philpott.
In April of 2003, Mick Philpott, Maria Duffy, and Paul Mosley were all found guilty on six counts of manslaughter. Philpott was described by Mrs. Justice Thirlwall as the driving force behind the plot. She sentenced him to life imprisonment with a minimum of 15 years. During the sentencing phase, she addressed Philpott and stated, quote, "You are a disturbingly dangerous man. Your guiding principle is what Mick Philpott wants, Mick Philpott gets. You have no moral compass," end quote. Duffy and Mosley were both sentenced to 17 years, with the possibility of parole after 8 years. As the trio were led out of the courtroom, family members applauded while one shouted, quote, "Die, Mick, die," end quote. Philpott responded by sticking up his two fingers and grinning. While behind bars, Philpott and Duffy filed for divorce. Duffy hopes that she will be paroled in 2021, just in time for her 40th birthday. Both she and Mosley are expected to serve 8.5 years, which is just little over 1 year for each life that they cruelly took. From prison, all three have professed their innocence. Philpott wrote several letters to old friends during which he claimed that he was set up by police and convicted solely on circumstantial evidence and bad character.
I even apologise to that bloke for not being able to save his babies. And that killed me. That destroyed me. I would have died for his kids. If only he would have just shown me some inspiration inside himself, I would have died. You know, my kids would have lost their dad. But they would have lost it for a good reason, because I'd do it for them. And I'd expect any father to do the same if it was me who needed help.
In the wake of the blaze, many questioned why hard-working taxpayers were funding lifestyles like Philpott's and called for a complete overhaul of the benefits system. But evil people like Mick Philpott are not created by their lifestyle or occupational choices. The issue lies with the systematic failures that allow people like Mick Philpott to commit crime. Mick Philpott was a criminal long before he was on benefits. He had a history of extreme violence and therefore rudimentary child protection procedures should have been in place, but yet they weren't. While Britain was fixated on persecuting somebody on welfare, they took the spotlight away from the real crimes that Philpott had committed and essentially allowed this abusive control freak to commit the worst crime of all. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to give a big, massive thank you to our new Patreons, Dane and Frankie Phoenix. Morbidology is a one-woman podcast, so the support really does go a long way in helping me cover the costs of hosting, producing, researching, and all that important stuff that goes into making a podcast. If you're interested in ad-free episodes, early release episodes and articles, and other goodies, make sure you check us out on Patreon. I'd also like to thank everybody that has taken the time to leave a nice review on iTunes, and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, shared an episode, commented on an episode. I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, guys, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
Do you love a good Lifetime movie as much as I do? Do you find yourself screaming at the television for the heroine to do or not to do something you know she should or shouldn't be doing? This is Shannon from Shannon and Everybody's Business Podcast coming at you with something new. Lessons from Lifetime, a podcast where I dig out the lessons from Lifetime movies and bring them here just for you. There are so many lessons that can be learned, ladies. I'm not kidding. If the bad guy looks dead, let's double and triple check before we turn and walk away. How about we just stop meeting people online altogether? Let's not introduce ourselves to the new neighbors down the street. And definitely, definitely not help that good-looking guy out on the side of the road. He will stalk and or murder you. So join me each week. I'll be covering the classics like Death of a Cheerleader and Every Woman's Dream to the newer ones like Jodi Arias' Dirty Little Secret and my new favorite, Love You to Death, The Story of the Munchausen Mom. You can find Lessons from Lifetime on all your favorite podcast platforms. Can't wait to see you there.
Hi, we're Janelle and Tony Nucci, and we are hosts of a true crime podcast. It's called Our Lives, Their Deaths, and we have plenty of content available to binge right now.
While we cover famous cases from time to time, we try to focus on stories that are lesser known, stories of the underrepresented, and even the quirky or paranormal now and again. We pull back the curtain and share some of our early podcasting journey transparently and with no secrets. Feedback is always welcome.
We're just a normal married couple who enjoy telling these stories and spending quality time together. Along the way, we'll go on the occasional tangent discussing our lives, careers, and family, along with plenty of music trivia mixed in. We care about the details, the victims, and producing regular and consistent content. We take ourselves and this show seriously, but not too seriously.
We love our loyal and highly engaged listeners, and we interact with them quite often. You can find us on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, Podbean, Himalaya, and any other place you listen to podcasts. So please give us a listen. Follow us on Twitter at OLTDpod and Instagram at OLTDTrueCrime. Reach out and engage with us.
Once again, the show is called Our Lives, Their Deaths. A true crime podcast. Thanks for listening, and remember, don't count the days, make the days count.